Good morning, everyone. Like everyone else, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here. I've had a wonderful time. It really is a special place, and I've never experienced anything quite like this, even though I've done things which try to be similar. But I really think it's amazing. So I have way too many slides, so we'll just see how it goes. And some of it I thought trying to arrange my talk to be different enough from the things Damon presented 2 days ago. And so I may just go through things kind of quickly, just because I think it's nice to see them twice with a different perspective. And if we get caught up in discussions, it's fine. I'll jump to the end for some new, exciting stuff that I would like people here maybe to help me think about. And the one thing I'm hoping to impress with examples about fly motion vision is what a religious zealot might call like the good news of Drosophila. And so I don't know. Just maybe by show of hand, are there people here who don't understand why we're working on flies? Okay. Does anyone else? No, because at some point you might think, like, why the hell do they invite all these fly people? Right? And so, I don't know. It's not clear. I think if you're, let's say, a real biologist or a physicist, you might think, okay, it's like the fifth fly talk, what's going on? Right, and so I'm going to try to give you at least my perspective on the benefits of choosing a single organism and then throwing lots of technology and also being able to take advantage of 100 years of insight. Right, so if you find something very weird about your animal in the fruit fly, there's a good chance there's a paper from 50 years ago which already has some insight. So you're not starting from scratch, right? And much of what we do in science is incremental and cumulative. And so it's really, there's a huge benefit to working in an organism where a lot of people are also putting their attention. And there's plenty of open questions, as you'll see. Okay, so we work on motion vision. In the history of thinking about navigation and active sensing and all these questions, this business of optic flow has actually been really interesting and historically important. So this gentleman, James Gibson, who's the guy who coined the term optic flow, was an American psychologist, and he spent a lot of time thinking about how do you use sensation to perform action, and he really struggled with this, and he settled on optic flow, and he came up with this whole theory he called the affordance theory, because you can think of it as a kind of remote sensing, right? You can observe the environment and then plan your actions in the environment, right? That's one of the benefits of vision. And so optic flow in particular is a way to understand how the environment is structured relative to yourself, but that requires movement, either your own movement or the movement of the environment. And so there are some big questions, and as I mentioned the other day when I interrupted Damon, right, this, when we talk about optic flow at this point, this is purely a geometric concept, right? So if you just draw a bunch of lines doing something like ray tracing from the visual system to the world, and then you take a step through the world, draw the lines again, and you ask, how did those rays update as you move through the world, right? So that's what these little arrows are meant to indicate. So big arrows mean big movement, and the direction of the arrows indicates the direction of that relative motion, so the projection of these rays. And so there are two big questions in thinking about how you would do this for a robot, and certainly how you would do this on an animal. Right, so how do you compute the little arrows? That's what I consider the local question. And then there's the global question, right? So then you actually want to construct a pattern from all of these arrows, or something that looks like a vector field, and then use that either to understand what you're currently doing or for future planning. So those are the two big questions. I thought I would say a little bit of my own personal journey. Why do I even care about this question? I haven't seen too many people do this, but I think we're all humans and we have motivations for doing what we do. Right, so why do I work on this? So when I was a graduate student, I was actually a roboticist, and I looked around the country trying to get out of the state of Florida, where I looked around the country and said, what's the most interesting thing a roboticist could do? And it was to go to Berkeley and work for these guys who had convinced the federal government, the Department of Defense, to build tiny flying robots. I thought that was the most interesting you could do. And they were inspired by fruit flies. They were a little bit bigger than fruit flies. And it kind of worked. I mean, they came up with things like this. They sort of took off. If maybe people have seen the news, the graduate student in the lab at the time, this guy Rob Wood, is in applied physics at Harvard and has really pushed this pretty far. We still have nothing like fly-like control. So the control of the airframe, the aerodynamics, and all of that remains really difficult. I think the engineers say it's a problem of the dynamics fighting the mechanics. Anyhow, so what I did was something totally different. I thought, let's let those guys work on the airframe. I'll just think about the control problem, right? And so at the time, I was working for Michael Dickinson, who was a biologist, and he told me, don't worry about it, right? Like, we have so much insight about how insects use vision to navigate through the world. All you have to do is read these papers from the 60s through the early 80s and just extract a few insights, and we can do this. We've basically got it. So he handed me a big stack of papers. I got into it. And so I think this is an unconventional version of what people might call synthetic biology, right? You try to build an animal and see how it goes. And so when you do that, you start to ask a bunch of questions of the literature, and you say, okay, if I really have to write down, you know, the control laws, right, all I see in these old papers are a bunch of correlation diagrams, right? This variable is correlated with this variable. It actually doesn't tell you how to draw a control system, right? You just know that there are some variables that are strongly correlated. So you have to make up a bunch of things. And but in so doing, I got into this motion vision question, and again, I was inspired by the optic flow stuff. So what I did really simply was just build a gantry-based robot, so because we couldn't really, the flying robot wasn't flying, and it just had a simple camera with a fisheye lens, and I just implemented something like fly compound dye optics, just a spatial low-pass filter, and then put this through this famous Reichardt detector. And here you can see roughly, it's an old video, but all the little arrows, right? And you should see, actually, there's using optic flow to navigate, even in an environment like this, which is highly textured, is not actually easy, right? So you can't do it. So the individual vectors are quite unreliable. They're really locked to local features. And so you end up needing, you just, the solution, which I think we have plenty of evidence for in the fly, is you throw a lot of integration at the problem. So a lot of spatial and a lot of temporal integration, right? Lots of low-pass filtering and some pattern detection of some type. Now, the thing we were trying to do here was to simulate experiments that were going on in the lab at the time, where the flies are flying around in a drum of the exact same size with the exact same pattern on the wall, and flies do this sort of flight pattern, which has been termed essentially straight flights interspersed by these rapid turns that we call saccades by analogy to eye movement. So that was the idea, right? And this was essentially just a simulation, but in a robot, of what flies can do. Okay. There were some questions.
Were they getting visual feedback in what they were doing, the robot, or it was just...
There's a camera right here.
Yeah. So we're just seeing what that robot
is seeing. Yeah, this is what the robot did, and this was the robot's eye view. I mean, it was hard. I mean, this was like 2001, so it was just hard to like make this all work.
Is it in closed loop?
It's closed loop. Yeah, it's dangerous. I got injured by this robot a few times.
So, if you put a water flow and just take some
interval,
what's the problem?
What is hard about it?
Yeah.
No, it worked. You saw it, right? I mean, I was a first-year grad student. I got it to work. So it's not, like, fundamentally hard, right? I just mean that if you go into the literature on computer vision, so here's the practical example today, right? Everyone's got self-driving cars around. None of them use optic flow. Right, so the engineers have ignored all the insights from insect vision, and if you do computer vision-based algorithms for optic flow, right, it's computationally expensive, and then people aren't really sure what to do with it.
But they're wheels.
Exactly. So there are other things which are reliable. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So what is the robot doing here?
What's the robot doing? Collision avoidance. Don't crash. You could call it exploration while not crashing.
So when you say that using the information of optical flow, there's some specific algorithm for this.
So the algorithm is super simple. Sorry, I didn't mention it. This is just you have a pattern, essentially what some sensory biologists have started calling match filters, which I think the audio engineers use this concept too. But essentially, you have a spatial filter, which is looking for something like outward motion. And if I get to it, I'll show you neurons.
So
expansion bilaterally, right and left, and you just integrate it. And once you reach some threshold, you initiate a turn away from the side with more expansion. That was the algorithm.
So that's avoidance.
Exactly. Yeah. But many things will work, right? There's not just one way to do that.
But I mean, one strategy for avoidance is to stay still, never move.
Sure.
Does it ever do that, or do you have something forcing
it? No, it goes. Yeah, so actually this is related to what I was talking about with Damon. I mean, we also just used constant velocity. So I tried to get a velocity regulator based on optic flow, and it was unreliable and hard to do. So here I told it had to go at 30 centimeters a second. Again, the goal is to do fly-like things.
So the fly has a fixed velocity?
Pretty much. In that environment, they do. They slow down as they reach the walls a bit. But otherwise, it's a fairly, I mean, it's a nice Gaussian. But, okay, so then.
Are you right, 30 centimeters a second?
Sure. I mean, yeah. If, yeah, so they can fly. They'll fly a few meters per second out with, you know, non-cluttered environments. But a meter per second is pretty typical. Okay, so then I had a bunch of questions, right? I thought the literature was a bit unsatisfying, so I thought, okay, I'm an engineer. I can build some instruments, go into the lab, start to do some fly experiments, and then we'll figure out all of these control strategies that the fly is using. And so, like Julie, I was also inspired by Legos. Then we moved to Caltech. I was still working in Michael's lab. And so I built these little modular LED displays. Just to say it's a good thing, I think, to take a new look at old problems, both for the instrumentation and the biology. And that became quite useful because rather than solving like one problem, we could solve many problems. So we just started plugging these little LED modules together. And they became useful for electrophysiology, for walking behavior, for various flight setups, this takeoff thing, a little disco floor. We did many things with them. And that's not a fly. So I did some number of behavioral experiments. And then at the end, I tried really hard to look at all the different ways flies could use motion vision to do control during navigation. But then essentially the last paper I wrote, one of the papers I wrote was this one, roughly around this time. And so I was thinking about, a lot of people talk about multi-sensory integration, but vision is a pretty rich modality. So there are lots of things you can do within one sensory thing. And so I was doing things like giving the animals expansion from the side, right, as if they're being buffeted by a gust of wind, so they're being pushed this way, so they get a flow field from the side, and then combining it with object tracking. Right, this is just the backstory doesn't matter. This was a reasonable thing to do. And you get this fairly complex phenomenology. You get things like, if it's just expansion, the animals will turn away from it, and they're so the gain on this turning behavior is so strong that you actually get this phase lock with the temporal frequency of the grading pattern. And if you just have the animal tracking a stripe, you get this thing where they orient towards the stripe. And this is my favorite part of this. They actually do something that looks predictive. They already start, turn towards the stripe, so they flip. If the stripe is on this way sweeping around, they'll turn towards it, right? And then they'll actually, they'll start turning towards the stripe before it crosses the midline, right? So that's a predictive component, and it leads by a few hundred milliseconds. And when you mix them, you get this thing where sometimes they follow expansion, sometimes the stripe wins, right? And there's the combinations are not straightforward. And these were very easy experiments to do, and then you get all this very rich, complicated phenomenology. And so at the time, I had to write this up, and I wrote this very long discussion. And I basically said, we have no idea, right? If we want to explain this with anything other than phenomenology, right, just a description of the behavior as we see it, if we want to use some sort of brain-based explanation, it's totally hopeless. We have no idea what's going on. This goes on. I said, well, certainly this has something to do with the optic lobes, right? So I said, okay, vision should come from the visual system. So I knew that. All right, and then I had this very, I think I was just sort of depressed at the end of this. And then I said, you know, this totally underscores the limitation in our current understanding of the visual system. I'm just going to read this because this was like, and I said, a mechanistic description of these behavioral results would require an elucidation of the neural substrate for motion detection, which was this long-sought prize. No one has any idea how that works. For object orientation, we don't know how that works. For expansion avoidance, as well as for all these interactions between all of these things, which is going to happen somewhere in the central brain, probably. Totally hopeless. And I would say this is only 12 years ago, right? And I think the good news is we have a handle on maybe half of these things, which I said were unknowable, right, 12 years ago. And so I think, and sometimes this is why I think this is sort of the good news of fruit flies, right, is that they've allowed us to go in and get at circuits and neurons for things that I honestly never thought were possible, right? So after this, I was fortunate enough to move to Genalia, which is a beautiful place, no beach, but very beautiful. And that's where several people here, so Dima and Julie were colleagues. And they actually probably remember this at the very beginning. I just thought we couldn't even work on vision. It was so hard. There were, at the time, we estimated there were 150 distinct cell types in the visual system of a fly. How do you know which ones you would start on? So I worked on a bunch of other kind of weird things. I was a behavior guy. I liked instrumentation. And so just in the spirit of the navigation thing, I'll just mention one thing we did, which was pretty cool. I don't think, not everyone knows flies can do this. Maybe I'll back up. But so we set up, we were actually working on temperature sensing together with Charles Zucker and his grad student, Tyler. And then we thought, since it worked so well, we thought we could use temperature to do a Morse water maze. Has everyone seen this? Has anyone not seen this? So the idea is we can get flies to associate a visual condition. But in the dark, if you give flies a hot landscape and a single cool spot, they'll find the cool spot and they'll stay there. So you can turn the lights on and then associate the location of the cool spot with a consistent set of visual conditions, right? And then you can, over time, just vary the location of the cool spot and but maintain the same correspondence to the visual conditions. So it's basically, it's like the Morse water maze, which many people know from rodents, right? Except we use temperature, not this milky liquid. Okay, the point is it works. So here you can't see the visual conditions. That's why there's a little cartoon here. And this is a population experiment, but you'll see in the first trial, the flies are essentially looking for the cool spot and encountering it randomly. By the second trial, you'll find that some flies are already taking more directed paths, and they've learned the strategy of once you get there, you should stay there because everything is terrible except this one spot.
Oh, poor guy.
And then, so you'll see over time, and I should mention, this is not the best video we ever made. This is really exactly from the mean of doing this experiment 20 times, so some experiments are better, some are worse. But anyhow, you can see that by third or fourth trial, flies have, they start taking these directed paths, and there are always a few flies which are confused. Right, but this was, so we had a paper on this in 2011. We made some inroads after getting the assay to work. We made some inroads on the part of the brain that were relevant to this, and they directed us to the central complex, this mysterious place in the center of the brain, which turned out to be even more mysterious than the visual system. And so we actually, look at this. I think I can stop.
Michael?
Yes, sir. Yes.
So we actually had a question about that during one of the talks in the evening. It's my answer, whether it's a 1D or 2D problem, like memorization of the location that would be associated with the right temperature. So do they need 1D angular, or it's really they can have a 2D map of that?
I mean, so the map is a different question. I mean, the simplest explanation for what they're doing. So there were many follow-up experiments that we've tried, some more successful than others, right? You can get them to take diagonals, right? So here we always did, this is actually made the data analysis, right? So you can get them to go across the arena, right? So which is a slightly harder solution. But I think the simplest model that would be sufficient to explain what we see here is that the animals are able to store an association between an orientation behavior and a particular visual scene, right? So like when I see this, I should go right, right? So that's neither 1D or 2D, right? I mean, the solution is an association of an action to a scene, right? Then there's a whole bunch of questions like, how do you actually practically implement such a thing, right? But that proposal is sufficient to explain what we see, right? The kind of experiments you want to do are like kidnapping experiments, right, where you take the flies to any other location in the arena, right, and see if they can make a directed path to the target location, or if they have to stumble into the only track that they had previously learned. Yeah, those were, we never quite got those experiments to work correctly. We just kept smashing, because the kidnapping apparatus would smash the flies. There are a bunch of neat variations on the experiment. At some point we got a small number of flies to run a maze, so more complicated than just going for 2 points. We could get them to at least learn a sequence of 2 actions, right? So that they would have to get to this location, but they would have to do it this way, right? So it's not, again, you could just learn, it's the same type of learning, but it's sequential, right? It doesn't even really need to be sequential, right? It's just the way the experiment goes. They're starting at 1 point, but they can only go this way. So maybe that's less successful. Here, 2/3, 70% of flies will learn. That one, like 25% of flies will learn, but can do it.
What was the difference between the temperatures outside and inside the sweet spot?
So for us, in this case, it was 10 degrees C.
You said the behavior. You were learning anything about neuronal implementation.
We've been working on this for 10 years. And so now we've learned something. Yeah, we're analyzing the data, yes. But so we actually don't really know. So the central complex, which I think Vivek will tell you about later, next week, is the part of the brain that just kept popping up when we were trying to silence neurons and figure out which ones are messing up the behavior. But it took a long time to figure out what the central complex is doing with this. And I still think we don't know, right? But the simplest interpretation, it has something to do with integrating what you have learned, right, with a sort of ongoing evaluation of your behavioral plan, right? And so it's not actually, we don't believe it's the site of learning. So we still don't actually know where the learning happens.
Yeah,
right? We just think it's not in the central complex. But you need central complex
information is stored.
We don't know. We know that the change in the information, this is what we know now, unpublished work, but we know that the change in the visual signal that arrives to the central complex, right, that the change is upstream of that, right? So the change is present in the inputs of the central complex. We don't know where it comes from. So the rest of the brain is a candidate, essentially. So,
If you don't rotate the temperature spot, and then if you just turn off all the lights, including the external visual, can they, if you control the temperature, can they just pass integrate and come back every time?
Kind of, yeah. So there's a weaker solution to this, which is you just learn a distance from the edge, right? And so in the paper, we show that we have many, so if you screw up the central complex, right, what you see become more prominent is this, like, weaker solution, which I wouldn't call path integration. It's just you learn a... Right, walk at a certain distance from the edge, and more often than not, you'll encounter the safe spot. Okay. Right. So we did in the paper there. We did 8 variations on the protocol, right? And only two of the 8 end up working. So most of the things you would do, you don't get this rapid improvement in performance.
So if you make the arena like a really big, then
we never did that.
Oh, okay.
But that's a good idea.
So in this case, if you do an individual fly versus doing a group, because in group they might see each other.
We did that
you
too.
Try the individual.
It works the same.
It works
this
the same.
This is practical. Okay. Back to what we're talking about. So around this time, it actually turned out, mostly because of our director at Genelia, Jerry Rubin, was really interested in making specific driver lines that target specific neurons. And the best place to start turns out to be the visual system, because one of the issues which has become decreasingly controversial now, right, is this question of how do you define cell types and what really constitutes a cell type. And in the visual system, it's actually among the easiest places to address that question, because as you'll notice here, we have all of these repeating units, which I'll show you again, right? And so as a way of knowing that you have generated a sufficient set of tools that allow you to target individual cell types, if you can essentially light up a single neuron in every column in the visual system, then you know you've got it. And so that was an easier starting point. And so that really brought us back to working on vision. And so again, this is going to be a review from what Damon said, but it's worth taking a step back. I'm going to talk about optic flow from now on. Okay, any questions about that? Any other questions? Okay, so for optic flow, right, I think this is such an obvious question, but it's worth just taking a step back and asking, so do the animals actually use a structure of optic flow to guide locomotion? So I already showed you an example that they do. Damon showed you many examples that they do. Right, but the classic way of addressing a question like that, right, is to do an experiment where it's really the only cue you present the animals. Right? Everyone sees that? Right? So they have nothing else that they can orient to. And so that is the main reason why we do things like these head fix or tethered behavioral experiment, right? So you, the animal, the only stimulus, the only experience of the animal that is under our control here is the visual one, and sure, maybe there are some eddies in the room and an odor here or there, right? But we're going to look for the robust changes in orientation. And so this is an example of such an experiment in flight. So that's a flying fly. It's not to scale. And I'm going to show this twice. But this is a closed-loop behavior that we do just to sort of get the experiment going. And now, if you notice, now we're going to give the animal this coherent rotatory motion, and we'll switch the direction. If you look now, what you'll see is the animals are responding with an asymmetric change in the wing stroke, right? So, and this is single fly, single trial data, right? Very robotic, almost, you'd call it, right? And now we go, so we do this stripe thing. It's an experimental trick. It actually helps you string a lot of these trials together. And now we're going to switch, rather than going clockwise, counterclockwise, we're going to go up and down. And instead of doing asymmetrical steering, you'll see now there are symmetrical changes in the wing stroke changes, right? So the animals are either increasing or decreasing The wing stroke symmetrically.
What does that mean? When they what do they do with their life? So they
don't love this experiment, right? They're trying to land.
Yeah,
right? So we call that the tethered flight analog of the landing response. And usually it happens when there's sort of a mismatch between what the animals experience and what they think is going to happen. So sometimes it's very easy to elicit the landing response if you give them a looming stimulus, but they actually think they're approaching something. But also if the stripe is getting away from them, for example, they'll throw their legs out.
I noticed that the head is not fixed in these experiments.
Yeah. So we do it both ways. I just think it's actually, I'm happy you can appreciate how dynamic and interesting this behavior is. There's many things going on, there are some correlated things, right? The head movement often slightly anticipates the wing responses for the turning behavior. So I'm just going to play the exact same movie again and mention that we quantify this in real time. That's how we can do the closed loop experiment. Some people do this with video tracking. Here we use an old optical trick. So we just cast a shadow and we measure the amplitude of the two wings, right? So here you can see when the flies are turning right and left, we're just plotting the difference between the size of the wing stroke shadow on the two sides. It's a little bit low pass filtered. And now during this closed loop behavior, the differences are quite small and you get these oscillatory changes as they're trying to stabilize the stripe. Now when we go to the up and down experiments, you'll see that the difference between the wing stroke signals is approximately zero, but now if you look at the sum of the wing stroke signals, you get this up and down response. All right, this is a...
So how well does the closed loop work if the head can move?
Everything, there are small and interesting differences. Yeah, one of the papers I wrote in the Dickinson lab had a big careful analysis of head closed, head glued versus not head free. And most things are not different. There are a small number of things. The very subtle stuff is different, but it's pretty minor. And we couldn't really figure out why.
How much do they actually rotate like when they're free and head
then? They can rotate their head an incredible amount, right? So especially in what we would call roll, right? So if the head is like this, they could actually rotate their head. They look like an owl. Right? All the way. There's a big debate on how much they actually rotate their head. So if you glue a fly and you do crazy visual stimuli very strong, right, you will get massive head movements. And when people do all this high-speed videography and try to zoom in on a small spot while the flies are flying through, even if they've initiated a turn in that small volume, it's very hard to see major head movements. And so we argue whether that means they are moving their head or they're not, because the flight motor is not on the head, and the neck is like a little piece of spaghetti, right? So I actually think because you don't see head movements, it means that they are, you know, compensating a lot. Right? But it's an open question. Yes?
If you tilt the entire setup by 90 degrees or something, do they change behavior in another way?
Are we tilting the flies too, or just the setup?
Including the fly. So
everything's the same. That's a good question. Sanjay and I were talking about that. Carl Goetz, who's kind of the father of this field, has a paper from the 60s where
they
did that.
They don't care about gravity at all.
Not when they're glued to a stick.
So it's like up and down and left right asymmetry.
Yes, is a head fly centered coordinate system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. When they walk, for sure. When they fly, it's an open question. We can talk about it. Sanjay has interesting ideas about this. So the point is we have this behavioral evidence. It's very rich. I just wanted people to appreciate that compared to a lot of behaviors people do, this is a good one, right? So I saw this behavior, and I said, you know, this is a great, like, you could actually build a whole research program right off of this behavior. I think you saw there in 20 seconds, you have all this richness of behavior, and it's almost robotic, right, which appealed to me. And so then we want to reduce it to some like really basic mechanism. So now we're going to talk about the local part of it, right? So this is what the animal is experiencing, right? Just the grating is moving. And so what we know from classic papers, actually from the first paper from Reichardt, when he was thinking about this motion vision in beetles, is that the interactions you need in order to perceive the direction of motion are local, right? So if you have what people call apparent motion, so a flash of, let's say, a bar shows up here and then it shows up over here, right? The animals don't, in some sense, fuse that, right, into a single continuous percept of motion, right? These flashes of light have to be very close to each other. And how close they are was observed a long time ago to be something like the neighboring omatidia on the eye of an insect, right? So it was always known to be in a small neighborhood, right? And it's really roughly like two neighboring omatidia are certainly sufficient to drive a directional percept and a directional reaction. Right, okay, so what does this local computation look like? So if you reduce it to the simplest question, right, so we just pick two omatidia, two neighbors. We call these things omatidia, these little, right, so it's just two neighboring locations on the eye. And if we sweep motion in one direction, we're looking for a computational element that can generate an asymmetric response, right? So when motion moves in one direction, which by convention we call the preferred direction, you generate a response which is different from motion in the null direction. Right? That's the convention in the field. So what is the what does that solution look like, right? We call this a computational unit or a neuron that implements this. We would call it directionally selective, and it's as simple as saying did one experience the luminance transition before two or two before one, right? That's the basic question. And so there are many solutions to this problem, but there are two big categories which are certainly sufficient to solve the problem, which is either, because what you need is a unit which makes a relative asymmetry, right, between these the reactions to stimuli. Either you enhance the response in the preferred direction or you can suppress the response in the null direction. Perhaps you can do both, right? But fundamentally, those are really the two good solutions to the problem. And those happen to map onto the two classic models for motion detection. The one on the left is the Reichardt detector, and then the one on the right is this Barlow-Levick mechanism, which implements a suppressive mechanism. I'll just talk through these very quickly. How many people have never seen these at all? One person, two people? Okay, so I have a little animation. So the way this thing works, there's a time delay, and then you have an interaction of two excitatory inputs with a correlation stage, which is a multiplier. And so the basic idea is that when things actually do correlate in time, right, it's because the delayed arm and the non-delayed arm, right, the excitatory events arrive roughly at the same time within some correlation, some time scale for the correlator to generate a positive response. And in the opposite direction, what you have is you have the fast input arrives at the correlator before the delayed input. Right? So you have no synergistic interaction.
But you need a different delay for different speeds.
Kind of, right. Yes, that's so if everything was very sharply tuned, you'd be in trouble. Right? So the idea is somehow you still need so that's correct. And so here I put it as a unit delay, that would be bad. Usually if this is usually done with a low pass filter. So the Barlow-Levick mechanism works with a suppression. It's been termed something like a veto-like mechanism. So in this direction you have this fast excitatory input, it just shoots through this rectifying step, and then you have a slower delayed input. Right, that arrives, but it's too late to have any interaction. So in the preferred direction, things are just sliding through. And in the null direction, what you do is you kick off this inhibition, and the inhibition is going to be powerful and long-lasting, so it's slow. Right, and it has it serves the purpose of canceling out the subsequent excitatory input. That's the idea. So that's the way you would get suppression of the null direction motion. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so then where do we go to see what the fly is actually doing? Right, we go to the visual system. This is just some fancy visualization. We're still working on this. But here we have the lenses, and underneath the lenses, we have a bunch of photoreceptors, which you can just sort of make out here, so I'll emphasize a couple there. They're essentially light guides. They're little wave guides. And the photoreceptors are chock full of the rhodopsin molecules, right, throughout these little light guides. Right, so they're really, I think, many people here would be interested to know about all of the amazing specializations that are going on at the front end of the visual system, right, that we won't talk about. It's kind of an amazing piece of engineering, and there's a lot of really fancy stuff going on at the front end, but we're not going to talk about that. Right, but essentially what we have is we have these pixel-by-pixel relay of, at first, a luminance signal, which then becomes a contrast signal, so a change signal, which then goes into the visual system, which is back here. Right, so these are a few synapses into the brain. That's what we'll be focusing on. So if we take a slice through the middle of the fly brain, I think Damon made the same point the other day. I just want to remind people. What we have is we have columnar units. Right, so what that means is we have this preservation of retinotopy. So things which are nearby on the retina stay nearby throughout the rest of the brain. And so you can see that in this classic stain that we have all of these what we call columnar elements that are going here from the eye into the lamina, again, columnar elements, and then here through the medulla. Right, so these things are staying. So everything which is nearby on the eye stays nearby in the brain, right? So for this question of motion detection, that has a very specific and convenient feature, which is we can look at neurons way down here and ask, are they integrating from neighboring locations in space? Right? That's the basic property we need for the motion detection problem. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so there's been this like 60 plus year search for how motion detection is implemented. And in the insect field, everyone believes that the Reichardt detector should mostly be true. Now, there's a very long list of reasons why that is so. I was just going to show one, and this goes back to the first experiment these guys did. They put a beetle on this little ball. It's actually a wheel made out of straw, and they counted rightward versus leftward turns in the presence of different visual stimuli. And these are actually their data, right? So as you vary the stimulus speed, you get this non-monotonic turning behavior, right? There's sort of an optimal speed at which they turn really hard. And then as you go faster and faster, right, the reaction actually slows down again. And this was the fit of the model. So this looked pretty good. So like I say, there are about 10 predictions, strong predictions of the Reichardt detector. This is actually this is one of many, right? But I'm just going to use this to illustrate why the field kept going back to this model. All right, so it's the fact that it produces these kind of speed tuning curves. And you only need to fit a single parameter, which is a time constant, right, to do something like this. Okay? And so I'm going to make an analogy here. So I've been thinking about what the field has been trying to do as something like peeling an onion. Okay, and the reason I'm choosing the analogy of an onion, so what happens when you peel an onion?
Right.
Well, you do. That's true. No, I was thinking something else. When you cut open an onion, right, there's little onions inside, right? And so in some sense, that's what the field thought they were doing, that the nervous system, we're just going to start, you know, taking layers off, and we're just going to get to smaller and smaller and smaller units, which are going to have Reichardt-like properties, right? And that's actually roughly what happened. So we start off with a behavioral level at the outside, then we go into the brain. So here in the back of the visual system is an output structure called the lobular plate. And a lot of people worked on the lobular plate in big flies, and really on the back of the head. So you can put, if anyone knows the work of Bill Bialik, Rob DeReuter, Adrian Fairhall, right, it's very easy. I mean, this is electrophysiology physicists-like. You just put a wire in the back of the fly's head and you get beautiful data. It's a good experiment, right? So this is famously this structure. You just put a wire back here and you find a really big neuron that likes to fire to rotating visual stimuli. And so this fellow, Hausen, actually did most of the heroic work of characterizing the neurons here. And he measured things, again, that have these non-monotonic responses to rotating stimuli over a range of speeds. Okay, so then this is like one layer into the onion. Again, you find similar speed-tuned neurons. Now, we don't, at the time, they knew these were not the neurons that were actually doing the motion detection, but these look to be integrating over large parts of the visual field. So these are big neurons, and they integrate from lots of smaller elements. Presumably, those are the elements that are doing the motion detection. Okay, so then we get to Drosophila. I should point out this was 1982. And then that whole line of work, which was actually the basis, this was the project of the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics, which was founded by Reichardt and some of his friends. Right, this was their main project, was to explain this as a model for neural computation. And they did beautiful theory, but it stalled, right? And the reason it stalled is because fly brains are really small and the neurons are really, really small, right? And nobody had the tools to target them in a specific way. So little flies come to the rescue. And then really, I don't think there was much progress after the early 90s on these questions. And so with little flies, with Drosophila, now we can go a little bit deeper into the onion. And we can find these small neurons, and then we'll talk about this in a bit. These T4 neurons, again, have very similar tuning profiles. And so what the field came to understand is that these are probably the site of motion detection. So we want to get to those neurons, and we want to ask, you know, what is their algorithm? How do they do it? Any questions? So very quick overview. Again, we have these columnar units in the visual system. A lot of really beautiful work, especially from Simon Laughlin, went into describing this transformation from the retina to the lamina, how you go essentially from light measurements to contrast measurements, so to a change in light level. And so it's very cool. We're not going to talk about that. And in the back of the visual system, you have these large field motion-sensitive neurons, what kind of mentioned. And then this was really where the field was 10 years ago. And then all of these details started to fill in from many labs. And so just for the purpose of talking about motion vision, the first thing we now all agree on is that within the visual system, you have this specialization for encoding on and off. So those are either positive or negative luminance transitions. So just as a little cartoon of that, So an on stimulus, right? It's like opening a curtain when it's bright outside. So the edge that is generating motion, right, is brighter than what was there before, right? So that's an on stimulus. And off is essentially the exact same thing, but it's opening a curtain when it's darker outside than inside, right? So we call that off. So that's by convention. And so those are processed by different neurons in the visual system. So there's a rectification. It's not a perfect rectification, but it's there. And many people contributed to this, including Damon's beautiful paper. And I think our minor contribution was just to clarify where this happens, right? So it's very clear that it happens at these synapses between the feed-forward lamina neurons and the columnar neurons of the medulla. And then we also have on and off directionally selective neurons. So we have these T4 neurons, which are small field neurons here in the medulla, and they're the neurons which are responsive to motion for on edges. And then the T5 neurons, which happen to be in the lobula, are the ones that are responding to off motion. So we had to, it's kind of like bookkeeping. You had to go through all these cells and figure out who's doing what. Okay. So here's, rather than a schematic, this is a stochastically labeled picture of a few T4 and T5 neurons. Again, T4 are the on neurons, T5 are the off neurons. And one of the reasons we were convinced that these were interesting neurons and we should work on them is if you use a genetic method to silence them, you lose all of those behaviors I showed you before. Right? So there's clearly something very important about these neurons for these sort of orienting behaviors. Okay? And then there were some very important questions to answer, which is, how do they detect motion? And there's an anatomical question, do they actually receive offset, spatially offset information? Right? So those are the questions I'm going to address in the next few slides. Any questions?
Okay. Yes. The stupid vertebrate people, can you just point out the sort of the receiving end and the...
Yeah, I was going to get... Yeah. So these are the These are the dendrites.
Yeah.
Right? This is the axon terminal, and these are the cell bodies.
Thanks.
Right? So, so much way out here. I'll show more pictures later. Okay, so from now on, I was just going to talk about the on pathway. That's what we had focused on in the lab. And the reason we did is because it's entirely contained within the medulla. So it was more convenient for small-scale reconstructions of the neural circuit to work on a more compact part of the brain. And so these are the what we learned from light microscopy and electron microscopy and some connectomics is that T4s, which are, again, these are their little dendrites out here, receive their primary inputs from four cell types. The list is maybe seven or eight if you include all the weaker connections, but the strong connections are from these four cell types. And as you can see, they have names. They're individually distinguishable. The MIs are just medulla intrinsic. That's what they're called because they don't leave the medulla. The TMs are transmedulla because they go through the medulla. Nothing amazing about the names. Okay. So what we...
They're not getting direct input from the R7 and R8 cells?
Some of them do. Yeah, so some of them do. I mean, you can... MI4 definitely gets some R7 and R8. All of these things are detailed because we have a connectome of multiple adjacent columns in the visual system, and then the game there is to match the shapes of the neurons you know from light level anatomy to what you have from reconstructions in electron microscopy. Okay, so this is the only thing you need to remember. Right? Once you have a connectome, you need it so you can identify all the players, but then you can go and ask, is there an interesting spatial relationship in the inputs that these neurons are getting? So a single T4 neuron, that little, in the past people called them bushy dendrites, right? This little guy down there. Right, so if you then look at it in the plane of the medulla, right, so if you're looking down on it, what you find is that a single neuron has a dendrite which spans roughly 15 degrees, so it spans about three columns of the medulla, which corresponds to about 15 degrees of visual angle. Okay, that's just a simple result of the anatomy. What is less simple and was very exciting is that if you then look at the synapses between the primary input neurons and this dendrite, they have this very stereotyped spatial arrangement, right? So you have different input channels arriving at different locations on the dendrite. Does that make sense? Now, just to be clear, these neurons are everywhere. So these red synapses are the MI1 inputs. You have an MI1 in every column, right? But an MI1 is only going to make connections to this T4 in what we call its home column. And then the MI1s in this column are only going to talk to the T4 in one column over. Right? So this is a selective synaptic contacts. All the neurons are everywhere, right? But they're only talking to each other in specific spatial locations. So what's really convenient about this was a proposal which came directly from Mitya Shlovsky, who did the first round of these EM reconstructions, he thought, well, maybe these different genetically targetable neuron types represent specific channels of information to the motion detection stage. And I didn't know if it was true, but it's a really exciting and practical hypothesis because we can turn neurons on and off. So that's what we did.
So just to recapitulate, you're saying that the MI1 in one column, sorry, the T4 in one column receives a single MI1 input from an offset column.
I think so. So you may notice these guys are clustered, right? So these guys are clustered because physically these are where the columns are. So there's a column here. There's a column here.
Oh, right? So it is a little.
So you get a bunch. So you're getting like 30 synapses from one MI1 in one column, and a few synapses from the MI1 in the other column. This question has excited many anatomists. These reconstructions have been done now 4 times. They have mostly held up. So this is from the last paper, which is now in review, just because people ask, is it symmetric? Right? I didn't mention this. Sorry. These T4 neurons, they come in different subtypes. So they have 4 subtypes. And the dendrites are oriented in 4 different directions, so almost Cartesian, right, left, up, down. And so when you have the neurons oriented, right, you see it's the exact same sequence of input synapses, again, just flipped, right? So it's the same transformation happening for different neurons, and there's a similar story for T5, the off pathway. So again, we have roughly 3 spots of inputs. Okay. All right, so then that's part of it. So we have the anatomy. Then we need genetic tools. I'm just going to mention, many people have talked briefly about Gal4 lines, just the standard way we access neurons. So at Genelia, we're sort of intoxicated by one additional complication to the Gal4 story, which is we use an intersectional method. You basically just take the enhancers and you have to recombine them in order to get precise access to a single cell type. And so here's an example of doing that. We want to target the T4 and T5 neurons, which are in here, but there's other crap, and we don't want to mess with the other stuff. And so you can generate an intersection. Right? The details, I don't think, matter. The point is, there's a complication, which takes a lot of people's time and effort, right? But you can get specific targeting of single cell types with enough trial and error. And so here's what that looks like. If we just take a cross-section of the visual system, we can target the T4 and T5. And then you can do it for all the other cell types, right? So you can go through the visual system and generate driver lines for every one of the major input neurons. And that allows you to do a set of comparative experiments. Okay. So I'm just going to give 2 results from this line of work. The first is to ask, where does motion actually come from? So what are the first neurons that are seeing the motion signal? And so we did that in a simple comparative way. We can just blink a little spot of light in front of the neuron, or we can have the same luminance transition, same beginning and end point, but do it with a sweeping edge, right? So we start with off, we end up at on. So, and then if you do that to an image from the dendrites of T4 neurons, you'll see that there's a large enhanced response between the flash and the edge, right? So the stimulus history matters for T4 neurons. But if you do the exact same thing to all the input neurons, it doesn't matter, right? So all the input neurons, which themselves respond differently to the identical stimuli, do not care about whether they've seen a flash or a motion, right? So that kind of result lets us pretty quickly say that it's only the T4 neurons, right, are actually where you get directional selectivity, right? That's the first place you see it because none of the inputs have it. Is that clear? And there's something interesting that all the inputs are doing something slightly different. So you have a range of transformations on the same input signal that are present. Right. Okay. So, and then we wanted to ask for getting back to the story of the motion detectors.
Left, right, up, down is all the same for that?
For those guys, yes. Yeah. So we wanted to ask a question about, if you remember the motion detector model, there's one that wants plus plus and there's one that wants plus and minus, right? So there's one that uses an inhibitory mechanism. So we just wanted to ask, could we use our genetic tools to try to infer the signs of the inputs? And so we did this experiment many different ways. I'm just going to show you a single result, which actually sort of an amazing result that it's amazing that it worked at all. We used genetic silencing to interfere with synaptic transmission in the individual input channels one at a time. And then we did a behavioral experiment. We asked the flies to orient towards gratings that are either these off or on edges. So the only thing which generates motion, again, is either an off edge or an on edge. We did this for a fly walking on a ball, like Damon showed. And when you do an experiment like that, and you compare a control fly that has nothing silenced, with flies in which we've silenced the motion-sensitive neurons, right? You have these very large differences. Control flies are able to follow either an on or off stimulus, and the T4, T5 guys, by and large, don't follow the stimuli. Okay, so then what happens when we silence all the input neurons one at a time? So for the off stimuli, we essentially get no effects. And for the on, we got these sort of a range of different contributions, where some neurons, when we silenced them, we actually got enhanced responses to on edges. Some neurons gave us suppressed responses. And so very simply, we inferred, well, maybe if you reduce the response, it's because you've eliminated the contribution of an excitatory input. And if you have an enhanced response, it's because you've eliminated the contribution of inhibitory one. It was a total conjecture. Now, it turns out that that is true. Right, so now it's basically we have the same result, but like now with transcriptomes, and so we have, so we know that these are cholinergic neurons. We know that this is a GABAergic neuron, and this is a glutamatergic neuron, and we could talk about how we know it's inhibitory. But I think Damon knows it's inhibitory.
So would you expect this to be true if you eliminated the inhibition, like given that you're subtracting two units?
I mean, not if it's the only
stronger response.
No, right? I mean, not if it's the only, if it's the only inhibitory input, and it's doing exactly what it's supposed to do, right? This is not an obvious.
Is the chance that those are higher, like that the phenotype, like is this?
I mean, as you know,
logical or not?
I mean, we unpacked these phenotypes with a range of more behavioral experiments in the paper, and we did the best job we could to interpret what we saw at the time, right? But certainly, didn't tell us what the mechanism was, right? That was the sad point we ended up with in the paper, right? I actually feel pretty good about the identity of just the sign of the input, but not about the inference for the mechanism. Yes. I mean, we have a model which reproduces all the results, right? But it was unsatisfying, in my opinion. Yes.
So given that you introduced both the Reichardt projector and the Marl limit, can you...
We'll get to it.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna just do five more slides, and then we can talk. Okay. So this is like the simple summary one would take out of this is that we have right. We're gonna try to get from an anatomical receptive field to a functional one, right? So what anatomy tells us is we have a neuron, right? It sees a little chunk of space, and it appears to get a bunch of inputs sort of in the middle of its anatomical receptive field that are excitatory. And so this is great. So Reichardt detector wants excitatory input. So perhaps there's some really interesting mechanism, could be synaptic, could be something happening along the dendrites, right, which allows the neuron to integrate the slightly offset excitatory input. Right, that's clearly possible. Right, so you have some mechanism for enhancing preferred direction. However, we also found these inputs which are spatially offset and which are putative and likely inhibitory. And so, again, this also leaves the space open that across the entire dendrite, we have an interaction of excitatory-inhibitory inputs, which could serve to suppress motion in the null direction, right? So both are still possible. And it became popular in the field a few years ago to say, aha, this is great. We have evidence for what you may call a horrible motion detector. This is just by stringing together everyone's first letter of everyone's last name. And I think this is an interesting point in the psychology of scientists, because I think a lot of people... who've been reading, either doing or following biology, right? People often are presented with false dichotomies, and they're going to say it's either this or this. And if they're both good ideas, I think most people's bias now is, well, it's got to be both, right? And I think that was we contributed to this a little bit. There are a lot of people in the field. Damon had a hand in it. Axel Boris had a hand in it. A lot of people said, well, of course it's a hybrid mechanism, right? Because both are good, but both have some deficits, so we put them together. The challenge is we actually didn't really have the evidence. For it, we just saw some weak evidence for everything. And the main reason for that is that functionally everyone was using calcium imaging, and there are some issues with calcium imaging, as you can imagine. One is it's a slow, the signal itself is very smooth and integrated, and often we're trying to argue about time delays on the scale of tens of milliseconds, right? And it's a really terrible way to go about that. And then the other issue with calcium indicators is that they're particularly insensitive to hyperpolarization. So if we want to put a fine estimate of the contribution of inhibition, you can't do it with a direct measurement. Everything is going to be indirect, right? So what is the consequence? You're essentially looking for things to cancel with calcium, right? And then infer that there must have been a minus sign in there, but you really can't see it directly. which is fine, but it's really annoying. Okay, so I had a postdoc, this gentleman, Eyal Grunkman, very brave guy, and he said, okay, I'm going to try to patch these neurons, they're very small, and so he did, he patched the neurons, and there are some challenges. They're very small neurons, which is actually not the hardest part. The hardest part for us was a conceptual and sort of instrumentation challenge, which is roughly, this is the field of view of a single neuron, right? It's very hard to patch a neuron, and you patch it, and it's looking behind the fly, and you can't do anything with it, right? So we had to essentially convert our approach to that, more of like what's common in monkey single unit neurophysiology, where we had to map receptive fields of single neurons and then have an adaptive stimulus protocol to sort of zoom in on a single neuron. And so we did that. It took a couple years. He's a very hardworking guy. And so just a very brief summary of what we find. I'll just show a single result. The paper was published a few months ago. And so what we can do is once we map, we find a single neuron, we know where it is located in space, we can figure out the direction to which it's most sensitive for motion. So we can find this PD, the preferred direction axis, and then we can just start doing simple characterization, right? Just mapping the receptive field of that. And so this is a sort of cartoon of how it looks. So if we find a neuron, we get nice depolarizing excitatory responses if we're sort of on the leading edge of the receptive field. As we move towards the middle of the receptive field, we get a larger depolarization. I should mention, these neurons do not spike. These are graded responses. And we actually define the center of the receptive field as the point where you get the largest response. That's by construction. And then if you move into the inhibitory part, you get these responses which are excitatory at first, and then you have inhibition, a hyperpolarization after that. And if you'll notice, what we see is that the excitation is fast and the inhibition is slow. Right, so this already has sort of a flavor of what this suppressive mechanism wants. Then what we can start to do, I think Damon introduced it, you didn't talk about this, we can do apparent motion stimuli where you just do the exact same things sequentially, and so we can stimulate from the leading to the middle, and when we do that, we can do again leading middle, and when you do that, you get something very close to a simple linear sum, right? Small response followed by a large response, and we can do that in the opposite direction, first the middle, then the leading edge, and when we do that, we get essentially just the same response, but just swapped in time. And so what we see from that is if you restrict the excitation and the stimulation just to the excitatory part of the receptive field, we have no asymmetry in the response, right? So if you just take the integral of that, right? And so it really looks as if the excitatory part of the receptive field, at least for this class of stimuli, is motion blind. Okay, so what happens when we start to mix excitation and inhibition? I wouldn't be telling you this if we didn't see something different, right? So if we go in this direction, again, we get large response, small response. And if we go in the other direction, we start with a trailing edge. And then the idea is that we're going to generate some inhibition, which will be strong and long-lasting enough to cancel out the subsequent arrival of the excitatory input, right? So that's what we see. And so we get this, let's say, strong evidence for suppression of motion in the null direction. So what I can tell you so far, we've been working on this for a couple years, we have no evidence from our lab, from these line of experiments, using a range of stimuli and both the on and the off pathway neurons, that there's anything else going on besides this mechanism, right? So that's a lot to unpack. I'll just show you what a little bit of what I mean by that. So do we need anything else to explain what's going on, or is this enough? And so there we turn to a modeling approach. And so I'm just showing here, we use a reconstructed neuron from electron microscopy to do a biophysical model where we deliver visual stimuli as conductances on the input of the neuron, conductance changes. And the simulation we did is very simple. So as I showed you, we can probe the receptive field of the neuron by stimulating at a few locations. And again, we do more than the three I showed you before. We get excitation in the middle and some inhibition on the trailing side. And we can just fit this. So these are just static stimuli, right? Just these single position flash responses is what we call these things. And we can fit this with a very simple model. This is a weird way of doing these experiments where we used neurons, the environment, a biophysical modeling simulation environment for neurons as a kind of analog computer in an optimization loop while we fit a very low-dimensional simple model, which I'm happy to explain in more detail. And so that works. And then what you do is you just ask the model, how do you respond to a dynamic stimulus, right? So this was a stimulus that had nothing, that was not part of the fitting procedure. And so we just sweep an edge, right? And so of course we do the experiment first, so you sweep an edge in both directions. And you get a large asymmetry, right? A response in the preferred direction. That's the data, right? So we do the experiment first. We have a large asymmetric response. And then we can do the exact same thing in simulation, and we get a very similar response. So again, the simulation was generated for just for the static data, and then we use it to predict the responses to the dynamic data. And so we can do this over a range of speeds, and in both directions, we get a really good agreement. And so this suggests that you don't need a lot more. So we have continued working on this, and we've tried to see how far we could push it. These are kind of simple stimuli. So we've been doing gratings, we've been doing edges, and the models have to get slightly more complicated, but the general picture holds up. I was just going to show one thing which is kind of provocative, and then we can stop and talk. So people are asking about how the neurons look. Here's again, this is the soma of the neuron down here, the axon, and the dendrite. So what we did in the simulation is we deliver these excitatory and inhibitory inputs as conductance changes to the dendrite of the neuron. So that would be like a bar at a particular location. Is just a set of conductance changes with a little time history, which we fit differentially to excitatory and inhibitory inputs with different weights at different locations on the dendrite. And as I said, we do a good job of capturing the measured data. That's now I'm just plotting an index of how directionally selective the model or the neuron are to each speed. So it's just essentially the difference. We can do a really simple manipulation. So rather than putting all the inputs all over the dendrite, right, we can collapse all of the inputs to a single location. So when we do that, we have to refit the model, but we still do the same exact thing. So we put all the inputs at one location, and we get a perfect fit, right? So that already told us that, okay, actually the shape of the neuron for this result is not consequential. And so because of that, we were able to put forward a really, really simple single compartment model where we don't need the big neuron thing. But when we started, we didn't know. So we thought we needed a whole simulation. And so I just think this is an interesting point, and it's just one worth putting out there, because at least for this result, for this simulation, right, the shape of the neuron actually had no contribution whatsoever. Right? Now, this is not a generic statement about neurons, but as a field, I don't think we have a good theory about neuron shapes, and there are many examples in, you know, in slice recordings where people can get neurons to do really amazing computations. But here's a case where the shape of the neuron, if anything, is really just a way of collecting inputs over a small part of space. Now, maybe this is just a special case for fly neurons because they're tiny and the timescales that are involved don't even allow the dendrites to contribute much. But that's a possibility. I'm just saying to do this simulation didn't require any, yes.
But isn't it actually that true as well, that in the same way that Wang Chengli and Alan Roberts found that in the spinal cord when they're looking at xenopus, that the more overlap you have between dendrite and axon of two neurons, you just get higher priority of connection, that the shape is intrinsically linked with the territory that the neuron explores, and then the connection that they're going to make because you're developing, they just need to overlap to connect them, no?
I mean,
so it could be more about connectivity.
I'm agreeing with you. It's more about connectivity. Right. I mean, I think what I think that picture of the neuron with the synapses identified suggests is that making really precise connections is not a limitation, right? The neuron can make connections, right? If it needs to go, you know, one more column over and have a synapse just at the tip of a dendrite, it can do it,
yeah.
Right? So I think that is sort of the point, right? Is that at least for these neurons, a lot of the details of the shape, right, are really about making the connections and where the connections are made, because they represent information from an offset location in space, right? But other details, so a lot of times we spend time worrying about the variability of the arbor of a neuron, and I think for a lot of fly neurons, it's totally relevant from what we've seen in the visual system, right? It's really about where the synapses are, right? Neurons are highly variable, but the connections don't seem to be.
Right.
Yes.
If you do the opposite simulation where you put the inhibitory synapses further out,
yes.
Does that screw it up, or does that not matter? Like, so you keep the arbor,
yeah.
But you put the inhibition further away.
Yeah, no, I think it would, when we did this simulation, right, again, we did a model fit to try to reproduce the static receptor field thing, right? So we, all we enforced there is that the profile, the weights of the inhibitory and the excitatory input should be Gaussian, but their positions were fixed.
You mean the distribution?
Distribution is a Gaussian, right? So because we didn't want to parameterize every single location, right? So we just have a mean and a variance, right? So the means can change, right? And of course, because the hyperpolarization only comes in on one side, right? The only model fit that works, right, is where the hyperpolarization is offset. And if we flipped it, right, I'm not sure if the, we may also want to mess with the time, but it should just go in the other direction.
So I guess I'm curious, like, what needs to be true about the inhibition? Is it simply that it needs to be, does it have to be longer lasting? Does it need to act as a shunt?
Yes, it needs to be offset and longer lasting.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, what is true, it's true that we can mess with the simulation, right, and give the neuron incredibly long, like, membrane time constant. So we can give the neuron a more prominent role in filtering, right? It's just that those versions of the simulation never do nearly as well at explaining the experimental data.
Just to sort of make sure it's crystal clear, so that what needs to be true is the inhibition and excitation should come from neighboring or material. It doesn't matter where they converge on the postsynaptic neuron, is what you said.
That's right. Yeah. That's correct. But because the visual system is laid out the way it is with a bunch of tubes, essentially, right, that's what you get. Okay, so I have a brief summary, which is just to say this is our view of things, which is what you need are these offset excitatory inhibitory inputs. One is fast, one is slow, and then a bit of neuronal integration. So it's not super complicated. What it seems like is that what we find is a solution that looks essentially to follow the logic of this previous Barlow-Levick detector, but the details are different, right? So rather than a static nonlinearity, we find a dynamic nonlinearity, which is why we just call it neuronal integration. But I think what's really nice about this is that I'm not going to say we understand this problem, but this is at least an introduction to what understanding a problem might look like, which is you approach the problem from different ways and you start to find converging evidence, right? So we have an algorithmic mechanism which at least sort of structurally starts to match what we learned from the circuit implementation. Now, of course, when you do this, you can always find a few results that don't agree. But I think more often than not, the results are in concordance. And so I'm just going to say we also did the off neurons, and we find the same thing. So that's not important. That's really just for Damien. We do the off neurons. We find the exact same thing for the off neurons, which is kind of interesting and kind of not. Okay, so the weird thing, which is I think just worth thinking about, is so we did this whole thing. We were looking for the 60-year mystery to find the Reichardt detector. And when we get to the middle of the onion, right, we actually find no evidence for the Reichardt detector, right? So it's kind of as if we had been fooled, right? So we were looking for the tiny onion, and we find something totally different. And in fact, something that is simpler, right? So the reason I got into this, right, was when I was a graduate student in computational neuroscience, Christoph Koch, who loves the Reichardt detector, gives this whole thing about how amazing it would be to find out where the multiplier is in neurons. And so I said, okay, we should work on this problem. It's a great problem. Okay, so knowing that you don't need a multiplier is kind of a relief. And so I actually I don't have a good answer for why the Reichardt detector was enduring. Damon put forward a pretty interesting take on why he thinks the Reichardt detector is so explanatory, just because it's if you just write out a good solution to the problem and throw away all the high-order terms, you get a Reichardt detector. That's one answer. But I think why we were fooled is that, and I think one of the errors in thinking about this is that, you know, the model brings a whole bunch of computational elements into a single compact unit, right, where everything becomes interrelated. And what we find in the visual system is that it's actually not the case, right? There are many pieces of the computation that all contribute. And so it's distributed across many layers of the visual system. And so the right solution, in some sense, is the one that deals with the visual system as it is, not perhaps as it should be. And so at the input level, right, we're dealing with, we have these transformations into light levels. And that goes, right, that has to do with the biochemistry of rhodopsin. Right, that has to do with, you know, the waveguide properties of the optics, all of this stuff. Right, then in the lamina, you have these transformations into contrast. We have this. We have channels which are on and off, mostly rectified. We also have channels which are fast and slow in the medulla. Then we know we have this step where we have a motion step. And then afterwards, we have still more pieces which are relevant to what we see at the level of behavior, right? We're just talking about the first five layers of the visual system, right? Then we have these large-scale integrating neurons which care about the pattern of motion. And then we have this step, which we call motion opponency, which is where computed motion signals in opposite directions are mediated by an inhibition step. Okay. And so, just say, we're getting a lot of information. There's a lot of maturity in thinking about what's going on here. But in order to get to this point, it required this sort of stepwise analysis of the whole pathway. And so I think how we're going to understand the really exciting questions about navigation essentially by doing the same thing, but into the central brain. So the visual system was an easy place to work, but it's not clear if we want to get to, you know, how these optic flow patterns are used to guide navigation. It's not clear that the same approach wouldn't work, right? Which is identify major players, get driver lines for them, record from them, silence them, etc. Right? I think it would take a decade, but that's sort of what. So in my lab, we're moving downstream. In some sense, it's to keep us honest. So I don't claim that we figured all this stuff out. But one of the ways you would know if your understanding of the upstream circuitry is sufficient is by going downstream and asking whether, you know, new things are coming up which you can't explain by what you understand previously. So things like the what Damon saw, the differences between translation and rotation. Right now, those would be unexplainable, right? And so that does require finding the neurons that care about translation and asking who their inputs are. Right, so that, for us, that's the strategy. I know it's an open question about whether the approaches that have worked for peripheral sensory systems are applicable to deep brain circuits, but I think we just have to try it. And if you can't do it for the motion pathway with those very robust behaviors I showed at the beginning, then I think the whole enterprise is hopeless. So we might as well start here. And then I'll just go to, if there's a question, I was just going to go.
3 minutes.
Okay, I'm just going to say one thing, which is fun to think about. Right, is that visual systems are not cameras. And so these are neurons. This is just a marker for presynaptic sites. And there are neurons in the middle of the fly brain that go everywhere. And that they touch essentially every cell type in the visual system. And they're modulatory. So this is a neuron. These are octopamine neurons that respond to motor-related signals of many sorts. And they instruct the visual system in a number of ways which we don't understand. Right? So everything I've told you in some sense is kind of hopelessly simplified. Right? But again, there aren't actually that many neurons that do this. So again, there's a new circuit problem here.
Is it a retrograde signal?
It is, yeah. So the dendrites are here now, right? And this receives some number of unknown central brain and ascending signals, right, that and are used really to change a lot about what's going on in the visual system.
And what happens if you knock them out?
They're a little worse at fast stuff, right? That's about it. The dynamics, right, the adaptation is off, right? Visual responses actually look flatter, less adaptive, but, you know, we're working on it. But again, this is now just another circuit analysis problem in reverse, right? So it's asking, you know, who are the, you know, what are the signals that these neurons are getting? And then how do those signals affect their targets in the visual system? Right, so I think it's worth thinking about that. And this is my lab. And the people who contributed to all the work I told you is mostly Eyal. Alyosha is our fly wizard. He's the guy who makes all of the beautiful driver lines for everything we do. All right, thank you.
So that's retrograde pattern is really interesting. You know, in 2 minutes, you know, you're one's metabolic state will actually affect your vision. I mean, you know, people flying airplanes and they're starting to have trouble seeing. They're told to eat a candy bar and have their, you know, blood glucose levels go up. And yeah. If there's some metabolic input to the visual.
I mean, I think these neurons are an extremely good analogy to the locus coeruleus norepinephrine system. So they're like the arousal system for flies. I think the analogy is surprisingly deep and interesting, right? Both anatomically, biochemically, there's a lot going on.
Do you expect also a vertical pair, a pair for vertical?
Yes.
You have them or?
Yes, exact same thing. Yeah. I mean,
So that's all you have. That's all in principle. That's all you need. But do they actually have?
I mean, I'll just.
Yeah, maybe for diagonal ones, you don't necessarily need.
I'll just show you, this is my favorite question. This is what I was going to talk about. If anyone wants to like think, if anyone really likes geometry and dynamics and flow fields and wants to talk about this, so my favorite question is that the downstream neurons get these like swirly flow fields. I don't know if we're allowed to call this vorticity or not, but there's swirliness to the flow fields. And it's not clear whether you get these 45-degree angles by just doing a vector sum right, of a guy that goes this way with a guy that goes this way, or whether actually at each location on the eye, the axis to which a neuron is most sensitive, it changes. And I actually think there's better evidence for the second one, but it's kind of shocking because, again, it requires thinking about the whole animal as a unit. And so what it means is that the way you detect motion actually depends on the layout of your eye, right? And so we have a bunch of data about that that I'm trying to work through. So that's the thing I've been thinking about for the last half years, like where these 45 degree lines come from. But it doesn't look like, we have no evidence, we have no great evidence that it's a vector sum. But then the question is, well, what is it?
Thinking about the, going back to the two models, activation versus suppression, if you think about that, the downstream neurons from the cells,
yes,
the directionality could still have a impact in a additive way if there's some facilitation or defacilitation of the downstream cell, right?
Sure.
So the small big versus big small.
Yes. No, there's also a component. I mean, a related thing is, I should say, all the directionally selective neurons, they synapse onto each other, right? So, and it's in a really directional way. So the neuron that detects motion in this direction talks to its neighbor, right? Essentially giving him a preview of what's coming next, right? So that would certainly lead to a wave of directed facilitation, right? Which may have something to do with also the discrepancy in speed tuning, right? So not accounting for that, right? Would certainly, if you do account for it, it would allow the neuron to respond to faster
speeds. So there could still be a multiplier effect.
I don't know if it's a multiplier, but it's the thing we would at least call a superlinear contributor, right?
So, yeah. So does that account for the prediction that you saw earlier, maybe?
Which prediction?
The prediction
of what that's too big. That's too big. That's something else. I mean, I think actually the prediction sounds more interesting than it is.
Okay.
The idea is that for object tracking, right, on most locations on the eye, this was actually known from behavioral experiments in the 70s, really beautiful stuff from Mike Land and Tom Collett, right? So for tracking of like one fly to another, right, for most parts of the eye, you just care about the position, right, and you update what you do with respect to the position. And as the conspecific in this case starts to approach the midline, you really need to start paying attention to the velocity, right, more than the position. And that gives you an element of prediction, right? So if the thing is going this way, right, if the female is going this way, you turn to anticipate where she's going to be, and if you're going this way, you don't, right, which is different than what you do when the conspecifics are peripheral. But we find the same thing in stupid fruit fly who are not chasing females on the wing, right? So it seems...
Is it all?